This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour in Africa News Tonight.
Well, South Sudan is facing both drought and conflict. We are very concerned about women being raped, women and children being killed, unending conflict that affects everybody but women and children the most. And it's sexual violence, it is physical abuse, it is quite horrific killing.
That's Greg Ram, Vice President of Humanitarian Response for the humanitarian organization Save the Children. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, Italy's government predicts a big increase in migrants this year. There are more warnings of drought and famine in East Africa. And once again, teenage girls are being used as suicide bombers in northern Nigeria. We'll have these stories and more. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, as the UN warns that South Sudan is teetering on the edge of genocide and famine is declared in Unity State, refugees describe the horrors that forced hundreds of thousands of women and children to flee to Uganda. Overall, more than 1.5 million people have fled South Sudan to neighboring countries since fighting erupted in December 2013. The humanitarian organization Save the Children says many kids are too traumatized to speak and do not know if their parents are alive. It says it's concerned by UN warnings of atrocities in South Sudan and calls on warring groups to protect civilians. Greg Ram is Vice President of Humanitarian Response for Save the Children. He spoke with me about conditions in South Sudan that are causing women and children to flee for their lives.
Well, South Sudan is facing both drought and conflict. We are very concerned about women being raped, women and children being killed, unending conflict that affects everybody but women and children the most. And it's sexual violence, it is physical abuse, it is quite horrific killing.
Children in particular, they're very traumatized to the point where they cannot even speak. So in this particular situation, what are some of the things that you all are doing to really help them?
When children are so traumatized that they can't speak, when young children have seen family members killed, the first thing to do is get them to a safe place, to a place where in the very first instance, they can have enough food to eat and basic health care. But then Save the Children works at helping children restore their lives through child-friendly spaces, through caseworkers, talking to individual children, helping them find family who can care for them.
And I guess this would be the same in the situation where there was a 14-year-old who completed a 50-mile journey on foot while 8 months pregnant. So I guess she was heading from South Sudan going into Uganda?
Yes. So not only are there children and families displaced within South Sudan, but there are hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese refugees who have poured into Uganda. So on the Uganda side, Save the Children works alongside other agencies in the refugee camps with people who are trying to assist those who have fled. What we're trying to do is provide health care to help somebody like that, a 14-year-old pregnant girl who needs attention, needs prenatal care, who needs to have a space for safe delivery so that she and her baby can survive birth. We are talking about the absence in many places of even the most basic of medical care. And Save the Children is deeply concerned about how this conflict and how the drought have eliminated that basic care for, in this case, a 14-year-old girl who is 8 months pregnant.
And on top of these atrocities that are being committed against them, they are dealing with a situation of starvation. So this is something that just makes the matter even more urgent that the international community needs to respond. So what would you say then to the international community?
What Save the Children would say is that the very first instance, the conflict needs to come to an end and civilians need to be protected. But the world can't become numb to the suffering in South Sudan. 1 million children right now are at risk of starvation if they do not get nutritious food, if they do not get basic health care. Acute malnutrition is life-threatening. And what the world needs to do is to come together to help the people of South Sudan in their moment of need. Regardless of whatever is happening politically, children shouldn't have to suffer the war of adults.
Those that are making it to Uganda, what is the situation there like for them?
The good news is that everybody, including the Ugandan authorities, are working very hard to welcome and assist those in need who are arriving. And the needs are quite acute. The challenge is that the numbers are overwhelming. Uganda now hosts more refugees than any other country in Africa, recently surpassing Ethiopia, which also hosts a huge number of refugees, including many from South Sudan. So the good news is that there is hope of assistance for refugees in Uganda. The difficult news is that the crisis is not getting international attention. We need far greater resources. The world needs to step and respond to what's happening in South Sudan and to the refugees in Uganda so that Save the Children and others can provide the life-saving assistance that is so desperately needed.
That was Greg Ram, Vice President of Humanitarian Response for Save the Children. He spoke with me from Washington. The aid organization Oxfam says 22 million people in Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya, and South Sudan are in urgent need of humanitarian assistance and warns 17 million of them face acute hunger or starvation. According to the AP, Oxfam regional director Nigel Trix says the situation is absolutely critical. He warns there's only a short time available in which to avoid a famine across the region. Problems caused by severe drought are being made worse by conflict in South Sudan and Somalia. The UN says the regional humanitarian crisis is the largest since 1945. In related news, British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson made a surprise visit to Somalia today. He met with the country's new president and called for more aid to deal with drought. Also, the Somali government and the World Health Organization today launched an oral vaccination campaign against cholera in 7 high-risk areas. The vaccines are being administered in parts of Mogadishu, Kismayo, and Beletwane. Somali pirates who hijacked an oil tanker on Monday are demanding ransom. The pirates seized the ship, the Aris 13, and are holding 8 Sri Lankan crew members near the town of Alua in Puntland. Reuters quotes the EU naval force as saying the armed pirates are demanding ransom, but the amount was not disclosed. The tanker is owned by Army Shipping based in Panama. Somali piracy reached its peak in 2011 when nearly 240 attacks were launched, costing about $7 billion. However, international naval patrols, tighter security on board ships, and different shipping routes led to a sharp decline in attacks. With the arrival of spring next week and improving weather conditions on the Mediterranean, the Italian government is gearing up for a big increase in migrants. That's raising concerns and criticism. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following developments. From Rome, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about new media reports on migration.
Well, according to one Italian media report today, the Italian government is now expecting up to 250,000 migrants to land in Italy in 2017. That's 70,000 more than last year. A short time ago, I spoke to the Interior Ministry. They have declined to confirm that number right away, but this seems to be quite a reliable source. There have been meetings taking place in the Interior Ministry yesterday and today, a great deal of concern there, and that's a 67% increase over what has previously been seen last year. So we've already seen 16,000 arrivals in the first couple of months of this year, and there's a great deal of concern in Italy about how to respond to this wave of immigration that shows no sign of slowing down.
Now, not only in Italy, but in a number of European countries, there's a growing anti-immigrant sentiment. What has the reaction been in Italy regarding the arrival of migrants there?
The anti-immigrant Northern League, which is quite a vocal party here in Italy against immigration, has already spoken out about this projection, saying it's particularly concerned and the government's policy is inadequate to deal with this wave of migrants that we're seeing. From the government's point of view, there are reports that it is about to step up its talks with the organisation that represents Italian local councils, obviously trying to invite and encourage councils across Italy to take more migrants to shoulder the burden. The Italian government is also providing Libya with 10 patrol boats, part of its program to support the Libyan Coast Guard and increase security on that coastline to stop migrant boats leaving Libya and crossing the Mediterranean to Italy. That seems like a small number, though, and I'm wondering if that's going to be adequate to stop these huge number of arrivals that we've already begun to see in 2017.
Josephine, you mentioned anti-immigrant sentiment in northern Italy, and there was an incident regarding an amateur soccer player. Would you fill us in on what happened?
Well, I think this particular case gives us a great deal of insight into some of the emotions that are running high in Italy. Gianluca Cigna, a young player who was playing in a minor league in the city of Turin, has been badly beaten and may lose an eye after an attack after a match that occurred just a few days ago. Three men are alleged to have beaten him after he defended his Senegalese teammate during the game. The attack has generated attention across Italy and massive media attention as well. And the local mayor of Turin spoke out very proudly in support of what Cigna did, while his parents are calling for justice, saying that this particular case deserves more attention from the judicial authorities than what we've seen so far in getting to the bottom of what happened.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna from Rome. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, has renewed the demolition of buildings deemed illegal. This time around, the country's first creative hub for ambitious young people has been targeted. Reporter Kutsazi Zvinavashi has the story.
The municipality's demolition drive has demolished buildings across the city, targeting merchant stalls in residential areas and other structures. One targeted building is Moto Republic, the country's first creative hub that has become home to startup organizations and to many young people aspiring to be entrepreneurs. Part of the hub is made from refurbished containers, which is what the council threatens to pull down. An attempt to demolish the place last week was halted. Michael Chideme, the council spokesperson, justifies the move.
It's an illegal structure. What we have agreed with the owners of this building is they have to pull it down in the next week. So if they don't do it by Thursday, we'll assist them to pull it down.
Lorraine Bigoya is community manager at Moto Republic. She explains the concept behind the building.
Moto Republic is a creative and co-working space. And we opened our doors in October 2015. Moto Republic came together as a response to the community that needed a space where they could meet, network, as well as collaborate.
The hub offers internet, mentorship, and hosts various talks that provide a rare opportunity for budding entrepreneurs to meet creative industry leaders. The young people say, besides the potential for collaboration, working from the space is good for meeting clients. It also cuts costs on the expensive internet charges they would face if they worked from home. Magamba Network is the founding organization of the Creative Hub. Its director, Sam Farai Monroe, explains the council's first attempt to demolish the building.
City Council came through and began hacking apart the co-working space. Literally while people were still inside, they brought out blow torches and started hacking apart the facade. We had to call the mayor, who came through quickly enough to stop the demolition. He said he was not actually aware of where the directive came from, but they've now given us up until next Wednesday.
Monroe says this is a matter of misplaced priorities by council.
What are the priorities of our city council when they want to destroy a youth centre as opposed to just fixing the potholes that are dotted around all our entire road system? We are not doing anything illegal here. As we've shared with you, we've gone through and gotten all the necessary paperwork.
Tongai Makawa is projects manager at Magamba Network. He says Moto Republic will not go down without a fight.
There's a way forward. We're looking at taking legal action against the council, as well as mobilizing our community and networks just to rally behind, just to bring pressure on the mayor and town council so that we get answers, we get action and cessation of this demolition. Because we're seeing this action as an affront, where we have a city in disrepair, instead of creating opportunities and spaces where youth can create and make a better life for themselves, they're seeking to destroy the little avenues of hope.
It looks like most of the buildings targeted will be demolished, but Moto Republic's future hangs in the balance. There's been an outpouring of messages of solidarity and a petition signed by over 1,000 people which has pressured the Minister of Local Government, Xavier Kasukuwere, to visit the hub recently. He promised to meet with the council to stop the demolition. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashe from Harare.
20 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Well, once again, teenage girls are being used as suicide bombers in northern Nigeria. Four girls blew themselves up early today, killing two other people at a house near the Nigerian city of Maiduguri. A spokesman for the National Emergency Management Agency says 16 others were injured. It's believed to be the work of Boko Haram militants. The house was located in an area called Muna Garage, which has been a recent target of the Islamic militant group. The attack at a home, however, is not typical of Boko Haram. Suicide bombers mostly target crowded areas like markets and refugee camps. Recent cases of kerosene explosions in Nigeria have caused havoc in many towns. People have been killed and property destroyed. Dixon Salami Adama reports from Uyo in southern Nigeria on the cause of the explosions.
These incidences occur because some of the kerosene which is being used for domestic purposes in lanterns, cooking stoves, among other household items, have been adulterated with highly inflammable substances. In effect, lives and properties have been lost over the years. While the explosions continue to happen with increasing regularity, it has though intensified lately since the astronomic rise in the price of kerosene in 2016 over other petroleum products. Akwa Ibom State in south-south Nigeria has the highest number of occurrences. This made the Office of the Senior Special Assistant on Petroleum Matters to Governor Odom Emmanuel to recently organize a stakeholder sensitization meeting on kerosene fire incidents. Speaking at the meeting, the Akwa Ibom State Chairman of the National Medical Association, Dr. Aniekeme Uwa, decried the rate at which innocent lives were lost in explosions, saying that the deaths are unacceptable. He said over 18 explosions have occurred in the state since September last year. Meanwhile, a 42-year-old in Sikak Michael from Ikono in Uyo local government area of Akwa Ibom State said he recently lost his two children to kerosene explosion and that he too suffered serious burns.
Unfortunately, I lost my two children. I bought kerosene at Idodo Road filling station. Then I bring back to house, put for lantern. Immediately I want to put for lantern, the thing exploded and catch my two children. I bring them to hospital. Following day, the first one died. After 2 days, the second one died. So at the process, the fire burned all over my body. I stayed for hospital up to 2 weeks before I can recover myself. I'm begging government to make assistance to me financially so that I can build up my body and go back to hospital for checkup.
Another victim, Edith Okeke from Itam in the local government area of the state, said she and her four children suffered severe burns all over their body and also lost their clothes to the explosion.
My son wanted to put kerosene inside the lantern, so the thing explodes and burned many of my children, including me, burned. Even my children's school uniform and my clothes also. So as the thing happened, we ran to hospital to treat ourselves. The thing costs a lot for the treatment. So I'm pleading for government to do something for us. Help us at least for the part of the money that we spend in the hospital.
A kerosene dealer in the state capital, Otto Bassi, blamed the explosions on the activities of oil bunkers and pipeline vandals who extract unrefined products from the pipelines.
I think those illegal dealers with pipeline vandalism, that is to say, they will now bring the unrefined product to the market. When the consumer buy, they will not know exactly what they are buying. So that should be one of the major causes of the explosion.
Reacting, the public relations officer of the Nigerian Security and Civil Defense Corps, Akwa Ibom State Command, Thomas Owodigme, said they have made some arrests and those found culpable will be punished accordingly.
Nigerian Security and Civil Defense Corps in the state was invited by the state government during the kerosene explosion incident to assist in tackling the problem. We joined Government parastatal visited the victims in the hospitals, collected samples of the product for analysis purposes, and made some arrests as necessary. At the conclusion of the investigation, those found culpable will be prosecuted accordingly.
In the meantime, many families have stopped using kerosene in their houses. For VOA, this is Dixon Salami Adama reporting from Uyo, South Nigeria.
Africa's rising youth population is outpacing available jobs in the public and private sectors, leaving would-be workers vulnerable to exploitation, terrorism, and human rights abuses. Nigerian entrepreneur Tony Ilamelo believes the solution to Africa's unemployment problem is for the private sector to lead and drive growth, a philosophy he calls Afrocapitalism. He was on a two-day working visit to Ghana. Francesca Cockra-Forson reports from Accra.
The president of Coca-Cola Central, East and West Africa, Kelvin Balogun, says almost 50% of graduates churned out by universities in Africa each year do not find jobs. The International Labour Organization, ILO, estimates the youth unemployment rate in sub-Saharan Africa is nearly 12%. A World Bank report in 2016 said nearly half, 48% of Ghanaian youth are unemployed. Analysts blame the country's poor macroeconomic performance and a surge in population growth for the problem. African leaders have committed to reduce poverty in the continent to below 20% by 2030. But the entrepreneur Tony Elumelu said this cannot be achieved if entrepreneurs are not empowered. Elumelu believes the solution to unemployment is his Afrocapitalism philosophy, a concept in which the private sector leads and transforms development in Africa. Elumelu says African entrepreneurs must partner to create more jobs for its youth. VOA caught up with him after he gave a lecture to students at the University of Ghana.
Partnerships don't work well in Africa, and we must address it because collective efforts is better than singular efforts. And from my experience, I think trust is very important. So alignment of interest is key partnership for addressing partnership failures in Africa.
And Afrocapitalism is the solution, having that philosophy.
Afrocapitalism is the solution because Africans coming together to address, from private sector perspective, to address the development of our continent. Africans realizing that no one but us to develop Africa. Africans realizing that saving our monies abroad is not the solution. We need to let our governments know that what is good for private sector is good for the society.
In Accra, John Amuakusi enrolled in a master's program in business at the University of Ghana, hoping to be more employable. But if a job doesn't come his way, Kusi says he'll go back to school again.
One other option is trying to look for PhD programs outside Ghana or probably in Ghana. It's not just about the jobs. Yes, I want to get the experience. But
so if the job doesn't come, you further your education?
Sure.
And you're certain that with the PhD you get a job?
That's a high possibility.
Parry Alote, a freshman at the University of Ghana, is also worried about not finding a job after graduating.
I feel very worried because being unemployed is not something good at all. So I think going for leadership route, or you can go for internship or your master's, like doing something that will make you look solid.
In Ghana, the unemployment problem was worsened by 4 years of interrupted electricity supply, which resulted in the loss of thousands of existing jobs and closure of many businesses. Francesca Cockra-Forson for VOA News, Accra.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we look at Ghana, 60 years after becoming the first black African country to gain independence. The 1957 precedent inspired other nations to seek their sovereignty, and 17 African countries gained independence in 1960. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.